We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Mike Gapes, the former Labour MP for Ilford South from 1992 to 2019 and the Change UK MP for the same constituency in 2019, former chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee from 2005 to 2010 and Change UK spokesperson for Foreign Affairs and Defence in 2019. And I've got Mike on to discuss a fascinating new book which he's contributed to called Change, the Independent Group. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thank you.
So the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to contribute to this book?
Well, after the kamikaze mission of the 2019 general election, the five of us who had been left after the events and the internal divisions that we'd had, basically decided that there was no future in having our party. We the three of us who'd fought in the election, that's Anna Soubry, Chris Leslie and myself, had all lost. We didn't have any representations. And so there was no point in the project that we'd started with others in February. It clearly not succeeded. And so we disbanded the party. But we thought we should at least place on the record our perspective of what happened and our view. And we came to this decision around the spring of 2020. But of course, then the country went into lockdown and so we couldn't meet together and chat through. So what we did instead, we found somebody, a man called Peter McNabb, who basically conducted a series of interviews with us over Zoom and then transcribed those. And then he put together and edited this book based upon entirely our words, our interviews and an intermeshing of what we said, which gives our internal story. Now, of course, subsequent to our decision that we were going to do this, the book by Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire Left Out was published last year, which gives a version of some of the events that led up to this split in the Labour Party and then the formation of Change UK. But it doesn't give the whole story, and in one or two small aspects, it's not accurate. And so, in a sense, what we've done will complement and give further information to those who have read that book and are interested in what happened, the disaster of what Corbyn Labour and the split in the Labour Party, and is there a future for sensible centre-left or centre-right politics in this country with the polarisation which we now have between the vote leave, Brexit, Tories, and Corbyn Labour as was, and the long Corbyn legacy that we're now experiencing.
Before we talk about some of the things that are discussed in the book, I'd like to talk a bit about you and your political career before the events of the book. When you were younger, you were Vice President of the Council of European National Youth Committees. And I just wonder, with the way that the relationship between Britain and the EU has changed so much since then, looking back on that period, do you think that you could have predicted that the UK would leave the European Union? Or do you think that this is something that has grown much more in recent years and wasn't perhaps as prevalent in the 1970s when you were Vice President of the Council of European National Youth Committees?
I think, firstly, the CENIC was not an EU institution. It was a Council of Europe institution. Mm. It brought together the national youth committees of all the Council of Europe countries. So it was, in a sense, a West European Cold War organisation. And our job at that time was to engage and I was vice president responsible for East-West relations to try and build cooperation and deal with the conflict of the Cold War period. The politics is very different now. That, of course, subsequently, that was in 77 that I was vice president of CENIC, and 77 to 79. Now, the UK had only just had the referendum, the first European referendum, where Harold Wilson's government campaigned to stay in, because Heath had taken the country into the European community. And then Wilson, Labour was officially opposed to that, but Wilson resolved the issue by a referendum. I suppose, in a sense, Cameron might have thought that he could resolve the issue in a similar way. But, of course, he and George Osborne ran the dreadful campaign, and they, of course, didn't have the benefit of that time of a united Conservative Party, apart from a few nutcases. They had a very split Conservative Party, and they also had the appalling 7.5 out of 10 Jeremy Corbyn refusing to campaign in any serious way on the Labour side. But I think the context is very different. And, of course, the European Union was, by the time of our referendum, an expanded body that had gone from the 6 to the 9 to the 12 to ultimately the 28 country members of the EU, which we, you know, included a large number of former states that had been part of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet sphere of influence, and the Baltic states, which had then been liberated from the Soviet Union after Gorbachev. So the world is very different to what it was in the 1970s.
I'd also like to just touch upon, because of course this has been in the news lately, in the late 90s when Labour was returned to government under Tony Blair, you served in the Northern Ireland office as a parliamentary private secretary. Looking at Northern Ireland now and the situation that has arisen relating to the violence that has occurred of late in Northern Ireland, and looking back to that period when you were in the Northern Ireland office, do you think that the differences between the North and the South were in a worse state going into the Good Friday Agreement than they are now? Or do you think that even though that there is still tension and violence, that things are better now than they were in the late 1990s?
Oh, things are immeasurably better. Firstly, one of the things, I spent 2 years in the Northern Ireland office, and I was there in the talks when we got the Good Friday Agreement in Belfast in 1998. My minister was Paul Murphy, who was the political development minister, who dealt with all the nitty-gritty of the negotiations. Things are immeasurably better. The relationship between the, at least until Johnson, the relationship between the British government and the Republic of Ireland governments has been very good, very close. Started with John Major, who began the process with Albert Reynolds, and then Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern, and the subsequent Taoiseachs have worked really well with a succession of prime ministers. But of course, that has now been shattered, because when we got that agreement in 1998, it was predicated on the fact that, as well as having a common travel area between the Republic and the UK, which we've had for decades, we were also going to be in the same economic single market. And the big problem that has been caused, of course, is, and Blair and Major pointed this out during the referendum, but nobody listened to them, is that that basis of the cooperation has been put into jeopardy. And I've pointed this out in Parliament when I made a speech a few years ago about the fact that Ireland has an all-Ireland agricultural relationship. There is a one milk marketing body. Irish whiskey from the north and from the south is sold internationally by a promotion of Irish whiskey, including that which is distilled in Antrim. So there is a whole relationship there. And the other thing that's very, very different is that Northern Ireland, socially, economically, was seen in the 1960s and 70s to be more advanced, despite the sectarianism, than the Republic. But the Republic had that fantastic period of boom as a result of its membership of the European Union. There was, of course, a big bust and a recession, but it's come out of that much better. Dublin is transformed as a city to what it was decades ago. And there's been a huge amount of inward investment, particularly from the United States, but also from elsewhere into the Republic of Ireland. And of course, you've also had the social changes. You know, they've had women presidents. There's been the referendums to do with divorce and abortion. And in fact, on social legislation now, the Republic of Ireland is in advance of Northern Ireland. And we've got this legacy of the role of the Catholic Church may have been reduced in the south, but the Catholic Church in the north, combined with the extreme Protestants of the DUP, socially conservative, and that has is an interesting consequence. So there's been enormous change.
Obviously, one of the things that was a driving force in the creation of Change UK, the independent group, was the election of Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. Now, obviously, in the book you discuss the run-up to the leadership election, which Corbyn became leader of the Labour Party. But for the listeners, do you think you could explain what you think was the reason that the Labour Party ended up electing Jeremy Corbyn?
Firstly, part of this is due to Ed Miliband. The changes in the rules for the procedure were brought in under him, whereby people could sign up and pay £3 to become members, and the reduction in the role of members of parliament in terms of the voting for the leader, the getting rid of the electoral college. Secondly, when Labour lost office in 2010, after being in government since 97, 13 years, Miliband's approach, Ed Miliband, that is, was almost a year zero approach. There was no attempt to defend the record of the Labour government. And the narrative was very much that we're only going to go for the future, let's forget about the past. And I think that tainted the way in which the future politics of the party was seen. And of course, the members of the party, after we'd lost in 2015 with Ed Miliband, then there were people, one of the candidates, Liz Kendall, described herself as the Eat Your Greens candidate. And I supported Liz Kendall in that ill-fated episode. But she wanted the party to confront the reasons we'd lost in 2015 and also in 2010 and have an honest assessment of the benefits of what we had achieved in the previous years in government, but also why we no longer resonated with the public. But most of the members of the Labour Party, as I said in the book, wanted a comfort blanket. They weren't prepared to confront that difficult issue. And also others came in from various far left groups and former Labour members who'd left or been expelled for various reasons under the militant tendency, came back, some elderly people, but also a lot of young people were inspired by the idea, and I said there are parallels with what happened in the Democratic Party in the US with Bernie Sanders a year later, of lots of idealistic young people voting for a man who'd been in Parliament 32 years and never held any position of responsibility, an elderly white man appealing to this cohort of idealistic young people. And I think there was a kind of failure. The other three candidates, apart from Liz Kendall, was Yvette Cooper, who had served in government and very, very competent. But she had a kind of what I described as a submarine strategy of surfacing to make some important statements, but not actually campaigning particularly well. And Andy Burnham, who at that time had moved from being a Blairite, ultra-Blairite in the terms of the government, to try and position himself as the left-wing candidate in what he thought originally was going to be a three-person contest. And then Jeremy Corbyn's late entry meant that Burnham was no longer the candidate of the left in that contest. And so his flip-flopping didn't actually succeed. And Corbyn gave a very simple answer. You know, it was all about, we need peace, we need socialism, international cooperation, and vote for me, and you don't have to confront any difficult issues. And that succeeded because of a combination of his support from some far-left trade union leaders, particularly Unite Union, Len McCluskey, and this group of new members and also people coming back and joining. Lots of people came in to join the party just to vote in that contest. And these, I've described them elsewhere, some of them are clicktivists, not activists. And many, although there was a significant increase in the paper membership of the Labour Party, there wasn't an increase in terms of the people who were going around knocking on doors and doing the work of campaigning.
Now, you mentioned Andy Burnham there, and of course, in recent days, in reaction to the results of the local elections, a lot of people have been turning towards Andy Burnham, including some of those on the left, suggesting that he's a potential future leader of the Labour Party. What do you think of the transformation? As you mentioned, Burnham once being viewed as an ultra-Blairite to being seen as the hope of the left. What do you think has caused this change in the public's perception of Andy Burnham?
Well, he's had a very high profile in the coronavirus. He's done a good job as mayor of Manchester and Greater Manchester. And he is a man of enormous political ability. I mean, no doubt. I mean, he was a good minister, a good cabinet minister. My personal take is, I don't think the Labour Party should be trying to change its leader again. The problems are far more deep-seated. As Tony Blair himself has pointed out this week, as David Miliband in an interview on which I've listened to this morning on Times Radio has said, these issues are not about single leaders. This is about the culture and the identity of the Labour Party. And it does face... I think Alistair Campbell's written in the New European as well this week, an existential crisis. And I think that's right. And I think whoever inherited the disaster of the worst election result since 1935, whoever took over from Corbyn was going to face an enormous challenge. And of course, the pandemic and the restrictions on campaigning and the legacy of the Brexit general election have made it very, very difficult. But Starmer has done some positive things, in my view, on trying to reform the party internally. But the challenge he faces is big, really big. It's bigger. He's got to be a combination of both Neil Kinnock, who saved the Labour Party and turned it round so that it was on the verge of winning an election, but didn't in 92. And I worked for Neil Kinnock in that period in the 80s. And also of Tony Blair. You've got to both reform and change and modernise the party, but also project and win over the country for a sane centre-left politics. And I'm not sure that any individual is capable of doing that, but time is short. And so Starmer faces enormous challenges, but I don't think Starmer himself is the problem. I think it's the Labour Party and its culture that is the problem.
Now, one of the things that Chris Leslie mentions in the section of the book, talking about the creation of the Birther Club WhatsApp group, he mentions that none of you were necessarily inherently rebellious MPs as such. Do you think there's something about the nature of the House of Commons that means that even in situations when members of Parliament don't feel comfortable in the political parties that they've been elected to represent, it's very difficult for them to leave those political parties?
Well, it's not just the nature of the House of Commons, it's the nature of the British political system, particularly for the Labour Party. My longest ever relationship, apart from with my parents and my brother, has been with the Labour Party. Mm. I joined when I was 16. And I left after 50 years as a member. And I say in the book, you cut me open and like a stick of rock inside, it will be stamped Labour. I've still got those Labour values, even though I left. And I felt a big weight had been lifted from me and I wasn't agonising every day. Nevertheless, I still regret the fact that it came to that. I'm not saying that I regret the decision to leave, because people at the time said I looked 10 years younger, and I did feel that way. The question of loyalty and being part of something is very important in the Labour Party. It may be less so in the Conservatives, I'm not sure. Anna Soubry certainly says so. She thinks that, and she says that in the book. There is also a loyalty that comes from being part of a collective. You don't achieve anything in politics on your own. Mm. You have to work with others. And obviously people have personal ambitions. So if you want to get on and you want to become a chair of a committee or get involved on a committee, or if you want to become a minister or shadow minister, then clearly, being seen to be loyal is normally the best route, although sometimes being seen to be disloyal is the way to be put into positions in order to gag you and silence you. That has been known in certain, I think it was David Owen became Foreign Secretary at a very young level. A young age, because that was a way to stop him being critical on defence policy, I think, at the time.
One of the turning points that's mentioned in the book is the Syria vote, and of course the speech that Hillary Benn gave, which was very much in disagreement with Jeremy Corbyn. Do you think, after he'd given that speech, that Hillary Benn should have challenged Jeremy Corbyn for the leadership? Or do you think that if he had, it wouldn't have been successful?
Well, first of all, I have to give a caveat. I was in hospital in an induced coma at the time that Hillary Benn made that speech. I had my ruptured aneurysm on the 27th of November, and which is, and the actual debate was, I think, the first week in December. I don't think Hillary ever wanted to challenge for the leadership. I don't think that was what it was about. It was about what was right and what was wrong. I think the circumstances happened when the challenge happened and the no confidence votes in 2016. That wasn't because of the Syria vote. That was because of Corbyn's ridiculous remark about triggering Article 50 immediately the day after the referendum result. But the Syria vote was a factor, and subsequently also the statements that Corbyn made in 2018 after the Skripal's poisoning in Salisbury, March 2018. That was also a factor in this whole process. And for me, foreign policy was one of the main reasons why I thought Corbyn was unfit to be prime minister. And that's why one of the main reasons why I left.
Do you think, and just going on to when you did leave, that there were people suggesting that as you had gone from one political party to another, that, you know, you and the other members of parliament should have held by-elections to regain the seats under your new colours, or at least to see if you could regain the seats under your new colours. Do you think, looking back, that that might have been a good way to get better publicity for you, or do you think that that was always an argument designed about ensuring that there would have to be this contest and potentially getting you out of Parliament?
The problem we had, and I personally was torn about this, the problem we had was the timing would have meant that there would have been a reduction in the number of anti-Brexit MPs and pro-people's vote referendum MPs during the duration of any by-election. And this is at the time when Parliament was having votes that were on the knife edge, if you remember, in 2019, around the whole issue of the Theresa May's deal and alternatives, and the people's vote campaign was building and so on. And my view at that time, my view at that time was that the numbers were so tight in Parliament that it wouldn't be sensible to facilitate any by-elections at that time. But in retrospect, you might be right. I might well have been able to force a by-election, stand in it, and get a much bigger vote than I did in the general election. But we, you know, we never expected a general election in December anyway. So the issue is a bit academic now. But the example of people standing in by-elections and then winning as the incumbent is mixed. I think you can go back to, I think Bruce Douglas Mann resigned in Mitcham in Morden and forced a by-election when he joined the SDP. And actually lost, and Angela Rumbold won for the Conservatives, and Bruce Douglas Mann had been a Labour MP. The Labour candidate in that by-election was David Nicholas, because I lived in Putney at the time. I remember working for him in that campaign. And then, if I remember correctly, I think Dick Tavern may have resigned and forced a by-election in the 70s when
in Lincoln,
where and won it. And then subsequently, Margaret Beckett won the seat, I think. Or stood as the candidate. I'm not sure whether she was elected. Maybe she was. Anyway, it's a long time ago.
In the book, you mention that there were more Labour MPs who felt in the same way that you did about wanting to leave the Labour Party and perhaps set up another party. Why do you think that more Labour MPs didn't leave the party who felt the same as you and joined Change UK?
Okay, I think there are... Everybody comes to this from a personal position. You've got family, you've got partners, you've got friends and colleagues and staff who may well see, to be part of your Labour family, if you like. You've got... your own residual loyalties. And it's always possible to come to a view, well, I'll just hang on another few days and see if something happens. You know, it's the kind of putting something off, always delaying. And there's always a question of what is the right timing. I mean, in retrospect, if we'd have known there was going to be a European election, going when we did in February was not a very sensible time to do. It would have been better to have gone earlier if we'd have known. But then, of course, going earlier, none of us were ready to go that early. and the events overtook. And maybe it would have been better, if you're thinking long term, to not go just before a local election where you can't stand candidates because you aren't a party. Mm-hmm. And when we left originally, our intention was not to set up a party at that stage. We were going to set up a group of independent MPs. We're going to have the policy process lasting several months, a listening exercise around the country, culminating in a conference in the autumn, which would have then potentially led to the foundation of a party. And we'd hoped at that time in February that other MPs would come with us, because we knew that there was a group. Well, I'd been in discussions with 15, 20 more Labour MPs at meetings of different kinds who felt the same way as we did about Corbyn and the hopelessness of the situation. But for various personal and political reasons, they chose not to. And then, of course, as soon as we left, there were the seven of us, and then Joan Ryan joined the day after, which made eight, and then the three Conservative women came, and that was 11. The 11 of us, at that point, whilst you've got certain people in the Labour Party, like Emily Thornberry and Lloyd Russell Moyle, who were calling us scum and traitors and scabs and all kinds of other terms like that. In contrast, you had Tom Watson, the deputy leader, who said, I understand why they are saying this. We need to listen to them. We need to think about the future of our party. And he set up a group inside the Labour Party, in the parliamentary party, for the future of Britain. And that acted as a rallying point for disaffected MPs who probably are agreeing with us. And I had lots of private conversations with Labour MPs around that period who said, good luck, well done, I wish I could be with you, or things like that. Mm-hmm. And they chose not to go. And they were waiting for Tom, waiting for Godot. And, of course, as I say in the piece when I was interviewed in the book, Tom Watson didn't do anything despite setting up that. And then he was outmaneuvered over the summer by John Landsman, the owner of Momentum. Then Tom decided to stand down from Parliament completely. So the efforts that those people made didn't save the Labour Party from its terrible election defeat. But of course, some of them are still in Parliament. Many others lost their seats. But some of that group who were with Tom Watson around that period are now on Starmer's front bench. And others have got senior positions within various parts of the House of Commons.
You think, and you mentioned some of the abuse that you received there. Do you think that the toxicity in which there is still, not just in the Parliamentary Labour Party, but within the Labour Party in general, is beginning to ebb away with Keir Starmer's election? Or do you think that the toxicity is still there and it is still festering under the surface?
Well, I still get a lot of toxic stuff on Twitter and Facebook. But I have to say, once I'd left the Labour Party, the level of toxic stuff that I got went down remarkably. It was as though these people, you know, the pile-ons that I got, I still get them even now from some people, that they fulfilled their object, which was to drive me out of the Labour Party. And what I had, I was quite bad, but it was nowhere near what the women MPs get. And people who are prominent women in politics, the level of vicious stuff against some of the, particularly MPs who are Jewish or are black, it's worse than what I had. But I used to get quite a lot, and I acted like, I suppose, a little bit like a troll magnet on some of my Twitter posts. And I used to take them on, but it is very time consuming. and it can be very stressful doing that.
Now, you mentioned there some of the abuse that women MPs have received, and women in politics, particularly those from ethnic minorities. And of course, the other day, Howard Beckett was suspended from the Labour Party because of his comments relating to Priti Patel. What do you think the fact that someone who is standing for such a senior trade union position saying something like that says about the way that some parts of the left engage with their opponents?
I won't comment on the particular case, but I will say that there is a strand of vicious, anti-Semitic, misogynistic and racist bullying which operates in British politics, some of it on the far left and some on the far right. And I suppose historically it's no surprise because, anti-Semitism of the left is, or racism on the left is also quite strong, mm-hmm. Not just from the right. It's unacceptable. And I think it's always been there, but social media amplifies this. And it's something I'm glad that the Labour Party is taking a more robust approach, and it's dealing with these people, which didn't happen under Corbyn.
We've discussed different questions at length, the degree to which the Labour Party is changing or perhaps has changed. Do you think at any point you will want to or feel that you can rejoin the Labour Party?
I've thought about this. I've been interviewed about it by many journalists in the last year. I will not apply to rejoin the Labour Party unless I'm welcome. I have had no indication that I would be welcome. And under the party's rules, you are excluded from the party if you stand against it as a candidate or if you're expelled. I wasn't expelled, I resigned, but I did stand against it as a candidate. I think that could mean an exclusion for several years unless there's a special dispensation by the National Executive Committee. But my view is, if the Labour Party wants to ever be in power again to win general elections in the United Kingdom, i.e. to win in England and Scotland, then the Labour Party has got to be a comfortable home for people with centre-left politics like me. And I don't believe at the moment that it is, and I'm leaving aside my own personal case, I think there is still a very long way to go to deal with this poisonous, toxic culture, which unfortunately has come in too much in too many areas and is still there in some constituencies. I mean, one of the constituencies in Liverpool, I think it's Luciana Berger's former constituency, Wavertree, this week has passed a motion of no confidence in Keir Starmer. It's an indication of the kinds of things that are happening. And I think that the Labour Party has to basically go through a cathartic process and be reconstructed as a patriotic centre-left party that believes in the defence of our country and believes in a society of aspiration and doesn't regard people who want to have reform and support institutions of our country as somehow the enemy.
We're towards the end of the podcast. It's been fascinating to talk to you, Mike, and I have one final question. We've touched a little bit upon coronavirus, obviously not a great deal, and because of the pandemic, all of us haven't been able to do the kind of things that we would normally be able to do. So when things are in a better set of circumstances than they are at the moment, what one thing that you haven't been able to do are you most looking forward to being able to do again?
I'm a season ticket holder at West Ham, and I would love to have been there to celebrate the team and its performances this season. There was a ballot for tickets for the last match of the season, and there are 10,000 tickets for the game against Southampton. But unfortunately, there are 50,000 of us who have been disappointed. So I won't be there. But that's the going on the train, standing on the crowded platform, having a drink with my friends before the game, cheering, and then, you know, walking back to Stratford Station to get the train home. That's what I've missed most. I also go to cricket at Lord's quite often, and I've got tickets for the test matches against Pakistan and India, and I had one for the New Zealand game, but they're not allowing the public into that one at the moment. So, but that's what I would do enjoy most.
Well, I hope you'll be able to see West Ham very soon and be able to visit Lord's as well very soon, hopefully. If people want to find out more about the book, where should they go to order the book or find out more about
it? They can get it on Amazon. It's also available on Kindle. It's Change the Independent Group, edited, compiled by Peter McNabb. You can also get it through Waterstones as well online.
Excellent. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Mike. Great to have you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.